Alaska, the final frontier. Okay, maybe it's going a little too far to compare Alaska to space or even to the vast amount of ocean that's left unexplored. But when we look at land masses and places where we could theoretically travel, Alaska feels very remote and even foreboding. And while there are a few larger cities, such as Nome and Anchorage, there are also so many more small villages and towns, sometimes only accessible by plane or water, but not by land. Now, as someone who is perpetually cold, Alaska seems like the great frigid north to me, so I really hope to never see it. I'm sorry, it looks beautiful, but it's supposed to be 90 where I live today, and I've run the heater, my space heater today, so Alaska and I probably would not get along. Hello, everybody. My name is Rhonda Jefferson, and this is Mystifyingly Missing True Crime and Thought-Provoking Events. I know it's been probably 4 or 5 weeks, maybe a little longer, since we've spoken, but as usual, it seems like things seem to happen in groups in my life where one thing happens and, I mean, I got a call the other night that one relative was at the hospital, and while his wife was with him, she got a call from my father saying he was on the way to the hospital by ambulance. So in literally the matter of an hour, two family members were taken to the hospital by ambulance, and they're doing okay right now, but it just seems like things happen, like I said, in groups. So I'm sorry that my upload schedule is inconsistent, to say the least. And I don't do this as, you know, a full-time occupation or anything. So unfortunately, there are times where, you know, I'm not able to get these stories up as quickly as I would like. It's more a matter of time to record and not actually doing the research, because it's usually not very quiet in my house. So it's just finding that time to sit down and be able to record without everything going on around me that, you know, could disrupt the recording. So maybe with the summer, you know, when it comes up, I'll have a little bit more time. I don't know, but I hope to, because I have lists of stories that I want to review. But getting back to today's story, we're going to be looking at the disappearance of two brothers. Now, in the past, I've looked at cases where brothers may have been involved in different crimes. In one case, it was one brother was a victim where later on his brother became a serial killer. So, you know, I wanted to look at family dynamics, but this case is heartbreaking. Just when you hear of these two brothers that went missing. So before I get into the episode, just a few things that, you know, I usually want to go over, and that, you know, first, the stories that I discuss can discuss things that may be uncomfortable for some people to hear, and I definitely understand that. So, like I said, today's case will be about missing people, so that gives you an idea of what we'll be looking at. While I was familiar with this case and knew a lot of the information just, you know, from other things I've read or heard, I, you know, did look up some newer information just to make sure there weren't any updates or changes. So all of those links will be in the description of the episode. If I am referring to something I remember from, you know, reading about this previously and I may not remember which article it was, you know, I just want to put that out there. There may be a few things that I just remember from being familiar from this case that may not be listed in the description. Also, while I do the podcast and my other one as well to try to bring either awareness to cases to try to learn from events that have happened in the past. You know, again, this is not my full-time job or anything like that. But unfortunately, there are sometimes costs associated. Like I just got the most recent bill for the for a platform that I use sometimes to, you know, help out with the podcast, as well as some of the research. You have to pay to have access to certain things. So I will have a link to buy me a coffee or PayPal in case you want to or are able to donate anything. Any little bit helps. And, you know, I don't expect that, of course. You know, you're just tuning in to listen to a podcast. But, you know, if anyone would like to, that information will be in the description as well. Or just as importantly, share or like the podcast. If you're listening on YouTube, those options are there as well. Leave a comment if the platform you're listening from allows that. That just helps bring up the episode in the algorithm so more people listen. And, you know, that shares the stories as well, which is the most important thing. So getting back to Alaska. So Alaska may seem deceptively large, meaning sometimes when you look at it on a map, probably because it's not right next to all of the other states that are within the United States, you know, the lower 48, as they're sometimes called, it's hard to really estimate just how big Alaska may be. What's also deceptive is the number of people that may go missing each year. The entire population of Alaska is approximately, I want to give you a few sets of numbers. One is a comparison of the size of Alaska. Texas, I think when we look at it on the map, we can very clearly see that it's an extremely large state. Texas is 268,000 square miles. I'm just going to round it down because, you know, it's not exactly 268,000 square miles, but you get the idea. California is the third largest at 163,000 square miles. Alaska, however, is 665,000 square miles. So just at a glance, when looking at the, you know, total area of the states, Alaska is about the same area as the other top five states combined. So pretty huge. And I said about, so it's not exact, but, you know, just looking at all the numbers, it's pretty close. However, when you look at the population of Alaska, at least as of 2021, it's not even 750,000 people. Again, this is from 2021, but still, you know, my state is the second smallest state in the United States, and we have more people than Alaska has, which means our population density is very, very tightly packed, whereas Alaska is the exact opposite. So just using my state, which is Delaware, if you're, you know, trying to look at a map to see which is the second smallest state, but as of a 2023 number, there were a total of 58 total people missing so far, whereas that's at about 5.6 people per 100,000 that go missing. When I look at Alaska, there are currently 1,200 plus missing persons cases that are currently open, and that averages out to about 41 out of every 100,000 residents. And on average, that's about three times higher than any other state. But something I do want to emphasize with Alaska as compared to many other states is Alaska does have a number of visitors that go up there for the exploration, for climbing, some of the peaks in Alaska, for camping, for hunting big game. So a lot of those numbers could also be visitors. So a lot of factors to look at the number of people that go missing in Alaska. But, you know, looking at those or at the area where Alaska is, you not only deal with, like I mentioned, the mountain peaks where people may go missing when they're hiking or trying to climb. There's also just the frigid temperatures that if you get lost while you're doing any of the activities, that adds a whole new level of danger. There's wildlife, which hopefully you would not be getting that close to if you went up there. Definitely polar bears are not those cute little cuddly Coca-Cola bears from when I was a kid. I probably dated myself a little bit as far as that reference. Moose, who may look like they're just extremely large deer to some people, and maybe they're kind of awkward or lumbering to some, but they can be very, very dangerous, where even if they're not intending to hurt anyone, they're just these massive creatures that can end up hurting someone without even trying. There's also transportation issues, such as a lot of places, like I said earlier, cannot be accessed by land. You would either need a boat or a helicopter or a plane. So those add, again, another level of danger to just even getting around in Alaska. When looking at these missing person cases in terms of could there be foul play, probably the vast majority of people that go missing within the wilderness, it's usually something such as becoming injured, becoming lost, and then having, you know, the frigid temperatures or something else happen while, you know, you've become lost or become injured. However, Alaska has had its share of famous killers. I don't even like using the word famous. Maybe infamous killers is better, such as Israel Keyes, who was very premeditated and would hide kits of what he would need to kill people around the country on different trips so that he tried to elude suspicion when coming from Alaska. There was a killer called the Butcher Baker, so that kind of describes who he was right there. So those were some of the more famous or infamous criminals. But given the number of people that have gone missing and continue to go missing in Alaska, just think about that uncertainty that the loved ones feel with never knowing what happened to their son, daughter, sibling, niece or nephew. You just never know. And that's a missing piece, a piece of you that will always feel like it's missing. And unless you have that answer, you can't even begin to move towards closure. Now, personally, sometimes I think closure could be almost impossible to achieve given the situations that you may encounter. But without knowing what happened to someone, that's not even a conceivable option, in my opinion, that you can move towards that closure. So it's horrible enough if you have one person in the family that goes missing, but to have two, that's unthinkable and unimaginable. But that did happen to two brothers from Alaska, and they were the Palmer brothers. What makes it even more unusual is these weren't two brothers who were out hiking together and something happened. They weren't traveling and never made it to their destination together. These were two brothers that years and years apart went missing in totally different situations. So the odds of a missing person in one family is very small, but to have two missing in separate incidents, statistically, that's got to be one of the biggest anomalies there is. Now, the Palmer family consisted of four siblings, and three of which were brothers. The oldest brother was Chris, with Charles being the middle child, and Charles was also known as Chucky, and Michael was the youngest of the boys. Hannah was the only girl, and she rounded out the bunch. They were from Wasilla, Alaska, and like many people from the Alaskan wilderness, they participated in a lot of outdoor activities. Also, looking at the time period where we begin our stories, which was the 1990s, kids didn't have the draw of the internet or online gaming to pull them back into the house. The Palmer family, as well as many families in the area, would spend a lot of their time outdoors hunting or fishing, spending time in nature. I also think Alaska does promote independence. Even if you're surrounded by others, there are some things that you need to approach alone so that you're not dependent on others completely. Sometimes, you know, when there aren't that many people around, and, you know, again, just looking at those numbers, it's really, really not densely populated. You know, you learn to become more independent. Now, in 1999, the youngest brother, Michael, was gaining his independence. It was summer, so the weather was more mild than it would have been in later months, such as February. Now, growing up around the same time as Michael, and looking at kind of the ideas and attitudes around that time, I think as a society, we were at a crossroads. We were still at a time where a lot of kids would go outside in the summer and may not go inside except to use the bathroom or grab something to eat or drink. Then you run outside again to ride your bike down to your best friend's house. The date that we're going to be going back to in 1999 is June 3rd. Now, he had been spending some time with his friends that day and was going to be spending the night at one of their houses. However, when that friend's parents went to bed, they did sneak out of the house. There were some parties going on in the area, and even though he was only 15, he may have done some drinking. It was a graduation party for those that had graduated not too long prior to this. So you might be wondering why a 15-year-old would be invited or go to a graduation party, but remembering the population of the town itself, there was only 10,000 residents at the time. So my thoughts on it were that the high school and maybe even the middle school were together, and the kids were pretty close and tight-knit. My graduating class was 10 kids, so you know, it was not unheard of for people who were seniors and eighth graders to know a lot about each other because, I mean, you were pretty much in the same building all day, same lunchtimes, things like that. So, you know, I can see why a 15-year-old would be going to a graduation party at that time, just because the high school was probably pretty small. Now, as many of these kids going to the party were very young, they probably weren't used to the effects of alcohol. And so just having that many people around who may have been having their first drink or two, added with just this sense of rambunctiousness that you see around young people, things probably were not the most sedate at this party, let's just say. Supposedly there had been at least one fight that Michael was a part of, but it didn't seem like it was a very serious fight. And while I'm not condoning any type of violence or anything like that, it wouldn't seem like this small fight might lead to any type of long-term grudge or any violence. They were done at the parties at approximately 4 a.m. They went back to their bikes to head back to the friend's house. They didn't mention his name in any of the articles that I saw, so I'm going to call the friend as the alibi's house. and not necessarily alibi, as in, you know, he's committed a crime, which, okay, he was drinking, technically he was, but, you know. But alibi more in the sense of, I'm pretty sure his parents didn't know he was going to a party, so being at this friend's house would be the alibi. So the friend is the alibi friend, the house is the alibi house. So all of the friends that had gone from the alibi house to the party, you know, got to their bikes and were going to head back. But the alibi house was 9 miles away. So this is 9 miles on an Alaskan night, which could be pretty daunting. And while, you know, I might have ridden my bike sometimes a couple of miles at a stretch where I lived, you know, it may have been a very wooded area, but there were paved roads that I would normally ride on. So I don't really know what those roads were like where Michael would have been going. Were they paved? Were they wooded? Was it just a trail? You know, these were things that, you know, maybe he would not have thought of, or any of his friends would have thought of, going back at 4 a.m. as compared to when they left, when they weren't as tired, you know, when they didn't have a drink or two in them. Going back to the alibi house would have been much different than going to the party. So the boys did not ride like in a clustered pack. They went single file, and Michael was the last rider. And remember this fact. The kids thought at one point that Michael had just fallen behind them, so they stopped for a while to wait for him at a convenience store. After waiting for that while, they realized Michael was gone. But being teenagers, they really didn't think that there was anything wrong. They just kind of theorized that he may have wanted to go back home instead of riding the 9 miles to his friend's house. You know, it may have just made more sense to him to go back to his own place. Looking at it from, say, an adult's perspective, like I'm looking at it now, if they left at 4 o'clock, how long would it have taken him to ride the miles to his house? While I, you know, didn't see the exact mileage from the party to Michael's house, if I'm following the friend's logic, it sounds like it would have been less than 9 miles, because why would he decide to go home at 4 a.m. instead of going back to the alibi house, unless it was a much shorter ride? Otherwise, he wouldn't really want to get in trouble, especially if he had alcohol on his breath, or, you know, just that smell of alcohol. He probably wouldn't have wanted to go home right away. So this just leaves a lot of questions in my mind about the exact distance. But I also do understand the kids may not have really thought that far ahead or had the same perspective even that we may have as an adult. So for about half a day or so, everybody went along blissfully unaware that Michael was actually missing. His mother expected him to be home by the afternoon, and when he wasn't, she called his friends home. She spoke directly with this friend, but he told her that Michael wasn't there, and this was at 3 p.m. This means there had been almost 12 hours since he had last been seen around 4 a.m. So that's when Michael's mother reported her son missing. Now, something I will point out here is, like I mentioned, I had heard of this case before, and I've heard a couple of accounts where it's actually stated that Michael went to a convenience store and called his mother, and when she went to pick him up from the convenience store, he wasn't there. In the articles that I found today, it doesn't seem to validate that certain narrative. You know, in this case, the friends, they were the ones who stopped at a convenience store and, you know, waited for Michael before they realized or thought that he may have gone home. So that's just something that I've seen as a discrepancy in reporting. But everything that I've seen that's, you know, I haven't seen before says that he separated from his friends, not necessarily that his mother got a phone call to come pick him up from the convenience store. The police did begin to search, and pretty quickly they found a pretty ominous clue. They found Michael's bike, but it wasn't in the woods or near a road or anything like that. It was in a river. The police, though, were not quick to jump to conclusions, such as automatically going to the fact that he may have drowned. Of course, having a bike in a river, that is going to be one of the first thoughts. But Michael was also known to be a strong swimmer as well as a strong athlete overall. And the river that the bike was found in was not very deep. But more telling, though, was the fact that there was a log jam that was, you know, going in the direction of the current. So if he had drowned, his remains would have basically been caught up at the end of that, or right where the log jam was. So it would have acted almost like a sieve to make sure that he did not go through. So in other words, if he had been in the river, if they didn't find his remains close to the bank or floating in the river, they would have found it up against the log jam. More surprising, though, was the discovery of Michael's shoes. Now, you might be thinking that I'm going to say that they were next to the river or something like that. But while the shoes were wet when they were found, they were actually closer to an airstrip that was close to the river, and they just weren't thrown down either. They were neatly placed by the airstrip. Unfortunately, there had been no activity at the airstrip that night when he went missing, so there were not any potential witnesses that may have seen him. There were about 50 people involved in the search for Michael, and they looked through the woods and they watched the river, but nothing was ever found other than these clues. So the clue about the shoes, where the bike was found, they're kind of confusing, at least to me. The rumor mill was also directing people back to the parties that had been taking place that night. You know, as you may recall, I mentioned that Michael may have been part of a fight, and many people thought that something happened in relation to a fight that had occurred that night. Now, in a classic investigator's tool, which I kind of have diverging thoughts about, investigators used polygraphs to try to determine what happened and to find out if anybody had been lying. You know, they wanted to track down as many people as they could that had attended any of the parties. And when they did, you know, give the polygraphs, everybody passed. We do have to remember, though, that polygraphs are not admissible in court, and there is a reason for that. So we can never, you know, look at a polygraph and 100% say that it was accurate. Now, Michael's older brother, Chris, had some differing views about the bike. He's actually not sure if the bike was his brother's that was actually found. He's not disputing that a bike was found, just that he does not believe that it was Michael's bike. One would think that the clearest explanation would be the only explanation. So kind of Occam's razor here, that the most direct, simplest explanation is what occurred. It may look like he went off road and had some type of accident. Maybe he pulled over to either rest or relieve himself, and somehow something tragic happened. But some members of Michael's family don't believe that's the whole story. There was a total of four boys with Michael that night. Michael's father doesn't believe that those three friends are telling the whole story. In an effort to find Michael, Mr. Palmer hires some private investigators And that's plural because when one started looking into the case, she actually started to get death threats. That is not normal for someone who just had a biking accident or who got lost. So after the first private investigator left, the second started looking into the case. This investigator thought that there was foul play involved with Michael by either being murdered or kidnapped. Now, these next accounts are rumors or unsubstantiated stories. While information about these reports are public, it does not necessarily mean that any of these events happened. So again, these are rumor and unsubstantiated stories. So I'm sticking to these terms so we cannot take these, you know, next retellings as fact. Now, one person who was a kid, a young person, said that Michael had been beaten up and then shot. Once word of the story got back to investigators, they questioned the kid, and he said that he had just made it up. That really wouldn't surprise me, as he may have been trying to get attention or seem more tough to, you know, others in his age group, not really understanding how this could have affect the investigation. Chris thinks that his brother didn't even get to his bike to ride home, wondering if Michael was injured or worse during the fight at one of the parties, and that everybody in a sense of panic worked to cover it up. So that would be enough heartache for any family to ever have to endure. And while Michael Palmer's family waited for years for information about his whereabouts to come to light, you know, they had to continue to move on. Time passes and, you know, the family grew up. The kids, his siblings, got older, not knowing what happened to Michael. Now, with this passage of time, looking at the possibility of possibly Michael getting into a fight and then a lot of people working together to cover it up, I personally think that if there was a cover-up because of a fight, it would have to be from a very small group of people, because if everybody at a party witnessed something and then kept it quiet for years, eventually someone would slip up. If it was just one or two people, maybe three at the most, there's a possibility they could all keep it inside, more scared of, you know, what the consequences would be for telling what truly happened as compared to, you know, realizing the amount of heartache that the Palmer family was going through. So if I'm looking at the fight scenario, I don't think it could have been a cover up by a large number of people, just a few at the most. So as these years passed, nobody could have ever imagined that something similar would happen again. But it did. The three remaining siblings were close. The two boys especially loved to go outdoors and, you know, participate in activities together and spend a lot of time with each other. Soon, though, Chris would have to experience a realization that he would be the only Palmer brother left when Chucky also went missing. It was April of 2010, so about 11 years after Michael had gone missing. Chucky, along with some other people, had, you know, just gone out of town trying to get some more winter activities in before the spring started to set in. And they were in, I'm going to try to make sure I say this correctly, Talkeetna, Alaska. And they were snowmobiling on Bald Mountain, just trying to get that last trip in before the warmer weather came in. On April 10th, it was decided that was going to be the day for their last outing. The group included the two brothers, Chucky and Chris, two friends of theirs, and their stepfather. The trip was just going to last a few days as a short getaway, and Chris started out with an issue with his snowmobile. The handlebars had actually snapped, which I'm not even sure how that happens, unless it was cold enough that the metal got weak. I don't know. But that's kind of a big deal if you're going to be on a snowmobile. So Chris decided to stay back at the cabin and work on the snowmobile. But Chucky went along with some of his friends. Now, in the group, Chucky was also last in line. And snowmobiling was not his strongest suit. And that's when Chucky, at the age of 31, went missing. The group said that it was around 7:15 when they noticed that he was gone. The group of friends had stopped and noticed that he was no longer there. They backtracked to see where he may have gone off trail or if he had had an accident, but they searched for hours and eventually the Alaska Mountain Rescue was called in. Chucky was dressed for colder weather, so that was a little bit of a relief, but he didn't have any supplies with him. So even if, he had the gear, the clothing to withstand the cold that would be setting in overnight, he didn't have any food, anything to warm water up to try to keep him warm or anything like that. Even though it was April, it's still pretty cold and there was snow that was still falling and that decreased the visibility, which made things even more difficult. But quickly after, there was a break in the weather and searchers found Chucky's snowmobile. The snow, though, had not only decreased visibility, but it had served to cover up any potential clues, especially footprints. While investigating the area around the snowmobile, they weren't able to discern any usable footprints. The snowmobile was not on the main path that his friends had taken, and because of this, one would expect to find footprints in the area with him trying to head back to the trail of where he knew that his friends would be. But there was nothing. And with the snow falling and even the wind moving to, move the snow, it would erode or fill in any prints that had been left or cover up any other clues that had been in the area. Now, I've read articles, I've seen short videos about this particular case, not just Michael's, but also Chucky's. And some people will try to emphasize the fact that there were no footprints as a suggestion, that something supernatural may have taken place. But I think we need to remember that it was hours before the search could begin. The friends that they were with looked for him first, so there was even just an initial delay in getting the search started. Then when you factor in the snow, the wind, there really wasn't much left, in my opinion, and in a lot of people's opinion, that could be used as evidence. Whereas some people will look at this lack of evidence and go straight to, something supernatural, and you can kind of fill in the blank with what supernatural means, whether some people think it's a cryptid, UFOs, I'm not joking here, but some type of time warp or time slip where he could go into another time. I know it. I honestly find those types of suggestions very offensive for the family because this is something that is very terrestrial. It's not, I just don't see the reasoning to go towards directly to something supernatural. There are very logical reasons why there was no discernible footprints or any other clues that could be seen. Now, Chucky had also been wearing a helmet, and finding the helmet itself could have shed some light onto what may or may not have happened. For example, you know, if the helmet had damage to it, that would indicate there had been some type of accident and possibly that he was suffering from some type of head injury. Even though the helmet will protect against, you know, major trauma usually, it doesn't necessarily prevent everything, depending on how hard a hit is. But if there was any indentation or any damage, that could have been a clue as to what happened to Chucky, as well as if anything had happened to affect his thinking. So people searched and searched and searched. And as the time went by, any hope of finding him alive was starting to wane. Searchers still expected to find his body, though, at some point. They were anticipating as winter melted into spring, then gave way to summer, and temperatures rose, that at some point when the snow had begun to melt, that Chucky would be found. But this was not to be. Chris, the only remaining Palmer brother, had a theory about what may have happened to Chucky. And that was, Chucky was not as experienced as the other members of the snowmobilers, and that the rest of the group were just going too fast and Chucky fell behind.
I do believe that is probably the case, that Chucky, you know, maybe fell behind, was in a rush, and had an accident of some type. I wish I did see some information about whether or not the snowmobile was still running, because why else would he abandon the snowmobile, other than possibly it wasn't working again. But everything was kind of against Chucky this day. First, his older brother couldn't go out at the same time because he had the issue with his own snowmobile with the handles breaking. So with Chucky, I don't want to say on his own, but really, he was the least experienced on the snowmobile, and he was the last one in line. You know, that probably his brother, Chris, would have been, you know, there either right in front of him or right behind him if something happened. So the other part of it that just kind of worked against him was the storm or snow that was coming in. While it may not have been abnormal for Alaska to have that type of weather, for those of us living in the lower 48, except, of course, for the exception of some states that get a lot of snow, it's probably hard to imagine having, you know, snow and the wind like that, that would erase the tracks. I know where I'm from, we do not get a lot of snow, so anything like that, you know, we wouldn't really have experience in it. And frankly, if we get more than a dusting a year, that's a lot. Even though we are getting a little more snow than usual over the past few years, you know, not really that much. So that definitely was a hindrance. When we're looking at it from the outside, some may see it as unusual that there were no tracks. But given the circumstances with the weather, it seems that kind of went against him. And I hate to say that in terms of why his remains weren't found, but there is wildlife out there. Especially most likely Chucky would have succumbed to the elements kind of quickly. And because of scavenging, animal predation, that may have pretty much moved the remains, and I guess the best way to phrase it is disposed of the remains. So I hear these two cases mentioned on a certain, I guess I'll call it, type of series. There's what's called a missing 411 phenomenon. I think there's always a logical reason behind the missing persons cases. If you're not familiar, it's this idea that people go missing in unexplained ways from usually national parks or state parks, but also it can extend to any other wooded or forested area. In pretty much every case that I've heard of, there's always been a logical explanation. In a lot of cases, those that do report on it, they get a lot of the information from one or two sources. And what happens is over the course of time, those things, those ideas are just kind of expanded on. You know, you have maybe one or two people that report on a certain case with these ideas, and then, you know, two more, then four more, then eight more, then 16 more. You get the idea. It just kind of takes off. There have been a couple of cases that I've heard of where very big pieces of information were missing that totally changed the way you could look at a certain case. So while I do consider myself pretty open-minded about some things, I'm also realistic, I think. I tend to look for the most logical and realistic explanations to any event. So I don't know if skeptic is really the right word to describe how I think in terms of anything supernatural or paranormal, but I do look for, you know, logical explanations first that can be proven by physical evidence or proven by statistics and the surroundings. But I'm not completely closed-minded to the fact that we don't know everything about everything, so I can't say never. However, in both of these cases, I do think there was some type of event, an accident, that led to their disappearances. I will say that Michael's is much more difficult for me to come up with an explanation, but that's because of two things. One is the shoes that were neatly placed on the ground. They weren't just kind of thrown off or floating in the river. And second, in regards to the river, why, if he fell in at a certain point where they would think that he fell in based on where they found the bike and the shoes, why didn't they find his remains? But an accident in that case doesn't necessarily mean an accident in the river. It could have been an accident at the party, on the way back to the alibi house from the party. A number of different types of accidents, and especially if it was at the party or with his friends, they may have panicked. And while investigators were looking at the river itself and the area around the river and the airstrip, kind of, you know, it distracted from where he really might have been. So, you know, again, I do think there's a logical explanation. But especially in Michael's case, there needs to be someone who opens up about it. I don't think anybody intentionally did anything to Michael, but there could have been, like I said, an accident if alcohol was involved. And not even on his part, it could have been some of the people who were, you know, getting into fights may have accidentally, you know, not intending to hurt him, pushed him or punched him, and something tragic happened. These are just speculations. I need to make that clear. There's not any evidence one way or the other, but I am looking at the more logical explanations. But I don't think that a parent, that a family should have to go through years and years and years of not knowing what happened to their loved one, and to have that happen twice is just unimaginable. I'm hoping that, especially with Michael's case, because that's one is a little bit harder to explain. With Chucky, there might not be a resolution, but, you know, it's more likely that he did go missing in the wilderness, and, you know, unfortunately something happened to his remains, possibly because of perdition. Whereas, predation, I'm sorry. But with Michael, it is harder to explain in there. So I'm hoping if something did happen accidentally, that somewhere along the line, someone will say something and give his family as much closure as they can actually get. Again, I don't think there could ever be complete closure, but I'm hoping that someday they will have some type of answer. So thank you everybody for tuning in today. As the summer approaches, I'm going to hope to be able to do research at a quicker pace where when it comes time to record, maybe I can find time to do that where it's not so loud around the house. So, you know, again, even if I don't necessarily have all the time to record, I will have the research done so I can grab certain amounts of time here and there to try to put everything together. I literally have a list of like 40 cases and events that I want to cover, and I really don't think there's any way that I will ever get through them all, because there's like 7 or 8 that I'm probably talking about I could spend 100 hours researching and writing things up, and I still wouldn't be close to getting all the information. So I will be working on those, but those will definitely come much later down the road. You may be getting a few shorter episodes coming up, you know, so that I can be working on the shorter cases while also researching some of the you know, more detailed ones. So I also want to try to become more consistent in the uploads. I always have in mind that I want to get 3 or 4 episodes recorded ahead, so if something comes up, you know, I can still have something to upload. Again, hopefully this summer I can get some time to do that, fingers crossed. But I thank all of you for tuning in and sticking with me. And I will talk to everybody very soon. And I hope you all have a great weekend if you're listening to this on the weekend or upcoming week. Bye-bye.